you can host the best backyard barbecue. When you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Hey guys, you're listening to Sci-Fi Wire's Days of Marvel podcast. On today's episode, it's our 8 days of Marvel countdown, and we're talking about The Amazing Spider-Man 2. Stay tuned. Hey everyone, and welcome to Sci-Fi Wire's Days of Marvel podcast. I'm today's host, Alexis Loynez. On this podcast, we are counting down to the release of Spider-Man Far From Home by revisiting all the Spider-Man movies, including all the Spider-Man appearances in the MCU, one day at a time. Each day, we tackle a different movie, re-explore the plot, call out our favorite moments, and discuss its place in the ever-expanding Spider-Verse. So let's swing right in. Today, I'm joined by my Sci-Fi Wire co-hosts, Danny Roth and John Irwin. Hey, guys.
Hello.
Oh, no. No, I'm kidding.
Oh, shoot. Was that turning people off already?
Yeah. Well, they said my name. And then yours.
Good luck, good grief. Guys.
Sorry, everybody.
Well, it sounds like we got a lot to discuss at this one. Well, we're also joined by somebody else, and that is our very trusted AI friend, Warvis.
In the events leading up to The Amazing Spider-Man 2, Spider-Man got a whole new-ish origin story. Peter Parker was bitten by a radioactive spider and gained amazing powers and started fighting crime in order to find the guy who killed his Uncle Ben. He also started dating Gwen Stacy and helped Dr. Kurt Connors develop amazing limb-regenerating technology that inadvertently turned him into the Lizard. Peter was able to best Kurt at the end of the movie, but not before Gwen's dad sacrificed himself to save the city. His dying wish was for Peter to promise to leave Gwen alone, a promise that Peter probably can't keep. In a mid-credit scene, Connors, in a prison cell, spoke with a man in the shadows who asked if Peter knew the truth about his father. Connors didn't know and demanded that Peter be left alone. The man then ominously disappeared.
All right, so we are pretty far in here. It's a really interesting situation because, first of all, this is the sequel to The Amazing Spider-Man 1, but also it's pretty much the second iteration of a Spider-Man movie that we have in such a short amount of time.
Yeah.
What do you guys think of that before we dive into the plot? Because I think that sort of really sets everything up.
Well, I think the stuff that's interesting about this film, the most interesting stuff, is the behind the scenes. Way before this movie got made, it was approved, right? So Amazing Spider-Man wasn't even out. Amazing Spider-Man 2 was already approved. And Mark Webb was already working with Sony on this idea that they were going to create like a Spider-Verse, an expanded universe. And the reason that they were doing that is because the MCU was working up to what? The Avengers. The Avengers is actually the most important movie at this point. Not Spider-Man, not Spider-Man 2, not Spider-Man 3. The most important movie to Amazing Spider-Man as a franchise, as a limited two-movie franchise, as it turns out, is The Avengers. So they're all thinking about that at this moment. They've set up this movie before the first movie was even out. And by that token, they're already thinking about Amazing Spider-Man 3 and 4 and Sinister 6 and maybe a Silver Sable movie, Black Cat movie, Venom movie. All these things are already being talked about before this second movie was even in production.
We also got to remember that this is 2014. We are in the thick of it with the Avengers and with the MCU.
Yeah, and everybody's just trying to play catch up at this point. I mean, DC was doing the same thing, right? And trying to get their Justice League movie in the works and fast track it as much as they could, really, at that point. Everybody's trying to play catch up, seeing how well that a well thought out team up sort of combined universe would be in the movie space. This just a little bit too late to the game, right? And kind of like you see with DC a little bit, you see it here, too late to the game, you try to rush things. It's not as put together as well as what Marvel has. And you kind of see the end product throughout this movie, to be honest.
Yeah, it is kind of a tough time. 2014, you know what else came out in that year? Dracula Untold. Did you know that?
Yeah.
That's the other one that came out that year that was the original setup for what was going to be a dark universe that also never came. That was sort of the same thing, trying to sort of create an expanded universe that happened a couple years later in The Mummy, which is The Mummy is sort of like the Amazing Spider-Man 2 of the dark universe.
It is a year of dashed dreams.
Yeah, but it is interesting that everybody is trying to compete with this thing that has been going on since Iron Man came out, right? So like, MCU had the forethought to set all this stuff up very slowly. Everybody else is trying to do it real fast.
To be honest, like with Into the Spider-Verse and then the box office success of Venom, I should say, there's a lot of potential in the Spider-Man universe to be its own standalone universe. Maybe not on the scale that you'd have with Avengers, but at least something a little bit more snackable, level of a, you know, shared movie universe with a lot of different stories you could kind of dive into, but we never got there.
Well, now Marvel's making amends with the latest wave of stuff. But why don't we dive into this one and see how it stacks up looking back 5 years after. And of course, we'll be comparing it, which is inevitable. But for this one, when we get started with it, it pretty much mirrors what we saw in the prologue to the first movie. We see Richard Parker at his lab in Oscorp. He's deleting files. He's killing spider specimens. And we see him on camera getting his accessibility and security revoked, and also recording a video where he says people will say, "I am a monster." So this is sort of the flip of that whole prologue that we saw in the first, where we never really saw what he was running for, right? Running from.
Now we all know that rich tapestry of Peter Parker's dad that we all were dying to know about.
Burning questions.
Yeah, couldn't wait. But yeah, so this is, you know, this is the thing that they're setting up. And there is, in the end, a narrative purpose sort of to it, which relates to how the spider stuff works, the spider serum, if you will, and why it works for Peter and maybe not other people, like poor Dane DeHaan, who I guess he has like youth serum, but he doesn't have spider serum.
Correct. And Dane DeHaan does show up a little bit later on. And has a pretty important role in this one. But I guess based on this intro, we pretty much know that the Parkers are doomed.
Yeah, absolutely. I feel like it's weird to set up two different sets of like parental figures for Peter a little bit. Like, you're used to Aunt May and, of course, his uncle passing being like a staple of his story. Having to set up the parents passing too as a part of his story, to me, was a lot to take in because I didn't know which one to kind of weigh. Like, there weren't as many stakes as these two passing as there were for his uncle's death, and in particular stakes in terms of that death weighing on Peter and being a pivotal part of his character.
Correct. Well, unfortunately, we do see his parents reach a very, very fiery demise from this. But after that, we pivot to Peter Parker, swinging through the city as Spider-Man, doing good deeds. And Danny, why don't you walk us through the sort of next villain we meet in this sequence?
Oh, you meet Rhino before he's Rhino. But I wanted to say this real quick, or I guess ask a question. How do you think the Spider-Man visuals, the suit in this movie and the look of him sort of like flipping around compared to previous films?
Well, I've always liked how Mark Webb shot everything from a first-person point of view. I think that was a very interesting device that he used. Mm-hmm. It sort of made you feel like you were in a carnival ride, so I appreciated that.
Yeah, I actually liked how much it pushed the different view you got. And you see it also, I think, in the fight in Electro a little bit, too, of just they slow down moments just enough to see how Spider-Man would work his way around the building rather than just like popping up here, web-slinging, and then popping up in another spot. You get to see a little bit more of the intricacy of his action. I didn't really appreciate the GoPro camera, that one shot. Like, that to me was like a little bit jarring in terms of trying to establish context of it. But I do appreciate them taking a different stab in shooting Spider-Man. That the kind of CGI element of how flexible he was a little bit weird. I feel like there wasn't much anatomy considered, but it was definitely more like visceral, and you could feel the action much more than what I think even in Spider-Man 1 or 2 back in the Tobey Maguire days had in it.
I actually think this is the best Spider-Man suit, period. I think this is the best one that they've ever done. I love the way that it looks as far as live action is concerned. Mm-hmm. And I think that it's got some of the best Spider-Man action sequences as far as mm-hmm. just him flipping around. I just wanted to put that out there
sure.
before we talk a lot of shit. I wanted to say one good thing about this movie.
I literally wrote down the effects are awesome. Like seeing those intricate movements is by far my favorite part of this movie.
Yeah. So he gets into a fight with this Russian guy as played by Paul Giamatti.
Alexei Sitsevich.
Yeah, and Paul Giamatti has gone on record of saying that he knows that he hammed it up, and he knows that his accent's not that good, but that he had a really great time. And I feel like that comes through. He's really going all the way over the top. He's just out there causing trouble, and Spider-Man's got to step in and put a stop to him. He definitely he whoops his ass pretty hard, and then he puts him in his underwear.
He does. Absolutely,
He puts Paul Giamatti in his underwear.
I love
it. And then I assume after that, Paul Giamatti, they yelled cut, and then Paul Giamatti cried. Apparently, Paul Giamatti like walks around New York crying. Did you ever hear that about him?
No.
Yeah, apparently he's a very public crier. So I just assume that like they yelled cut on that, and after he was camping it up, he just immediately went back to his use, which is crying in his underwear, I assume.
I love how they started with a lot of humor, too. Like, the quips Spider-Man had in the talking to Paul Giamatti in the truck.
Hey, my name is Spider-Man. You can call me Webhead. You can call me amazing. Just don't call me late for dinner. Get it? Not a shaker.
Are you a hugger?
I am killer.
Whoa! Okay.
And, of course, the underwear kind of joke to tag everything off at the end of that scene. I like that part because I think sometimes you start missing Spider-Man when you get away from the humor, and that's such a pivotal part of this guy. I love it. Starting off first action scene, you get a little bit of that familiarity of the quips and kind of that kind of youthful persona of his.
This sequence also introduces a pretty interesting tone or an interesting sequence throughout, which will become a recurring theme, which is he starts seeing sort of the ghost of Gwen's dad.
You're gonna make enemies. People will get hurt. So I want you to promise me something, okay? Leave Gwen out of it.
It does inform a lot of how the movie unfolds, a lot of guilt that he feels, and of course the commitment that he made at the end of Spider-Man 1 to pretty much leave Gwen out of it.
Because anybody he's close with, something bad's going to happen to them. And Dennis Leary is like, hey, leave my daughter out of this, please. And then he sings the asshole song. He doesn't actually do that, but it wouldn't have been great. But he's kind of right. Spoilers. He's kind of correct. So we'll get a weird note for the movie, which is that he's right. It turns out that he's completely correct.
Yeah. I mean, he's totally right, but I'm also like, I hate people from the grave trying to tell people alive what to do. And maybe it's just me exceeding 100 times in movies, but
does that happen to you often?
Come on, dude. Yeah,
a lot of backseat driving.
Wait, who's
backseat
back
driving
from,
ghosts?
Who's coming back from the dead, and what is it they're telling you not to do, John?
I don't know. I need to go talk to the Hollywood medium to find out who it is, but they're telling me a lot of things.
Wow. All right. I'm worried about you.
But I always hate people trying to live their life based on like dead people's wishes, to be honest, in general. And like this just kind of like irked me. Like, come on, man. Like, you're at least honest with her and told Gwen eventually that, like, why you were acting this way. And if then, I think in Dennis Leary would appreciate just working out together. Like, he wouldn't want to prescribe, you have to do this. Things
so bossy.
So bossy.
So bossy. But we
bossy
also
ghost.
We also meet somebody else who's going to be pretty key, you know, in this general sequence, and that is Max Dillon.
All the crime fighting you've been doing, and all of a sudden you take time out to come visit little old me, Max. It's amazing to...
So at this point, Max Dillon is the pre-Electro version, very kind of introverted, not on purpose, but because people force him into a box, and they kind of neglect him and ignore him purposefully. And so he's very, very left out and kind of lost, and kind of, to be honest, a little stereotypical nerd portrayal by Jamie Foxx.
I always thought that he was supposed to be on the spectrum. That's where they were playing him. That he looked like he had
Asperger's
or autism or something.
I can understand that. I just couldn't tell if it was that or if people keep forcing him into that that ends up being who he is.
He gets his life saved by Spider-Man. This is pretty key. This is the reason why I think this. Spider-Man saves his life and then gives him a little speech, which is to say,
you know, Spider-Man saved my life one time. Out of all the people in the whole city, he saved me. He said he needed me.
Then Max takes it very literally. like they're friends now, and he is absolutely essential to Spider-Man's continued success as the superhero in the city. And that is the reason why, like, that he takes such a literal interpretation of this statement suggests to me that we're trying to portray somebody that's on this, not to be so serious, but like, I think that's why. That's where I got that impression from. And I think that also Jamie Foxx wanted to take a kind of a serious approach to this character, because he'd had a lot of success with that in the past. I mean, it's been 10 years since he won an Oscar for Ray, but he did win an Oscar for Ray in 2004. And I do think that he is at this point still considering himself to be a pretty serious actor. I'm sure he probably still thinks that, but you know, and he is. But you know, I do think that he wanted to give a certain serious gravitas. And so I think he wanted to root that in something real. Why would this guy act this way? So that's sort of what I got off of his performance. And he was very serious about this role. I don't know if you know this, but when the movie came out, he actually changed his Twitter name to be Electro while the movie was out. So he was very, I don't want to say method, but like, you know, he was very serious about the role. A fun fact to know about it. But yeah, so yeah, he gets saved. He's taking this very seriously, but there's a place that Peter Parker's supposed to be, right? That's where we are. He's supposed to be graduating. Gwen Stacy is going to give a speech. Another fun fact is that speech, you know who wrote that speech?
You.
Yeah, it was true. It was me. And by me, I mean Emma Stone. I am Emma Stone. I'm really sorry about playing a Hawaiian that one time, guys. So Emma Stone wrote the graduation speech for this. She actually wrote it herself.
What makes life valuable is that it doesn't last forever.
But he's missing it. He's running late, and he's got to like throw his gown on and get his diploma. But she's, you know, she's the valedictorian giving the speech. And this is where we get reintroduced to her and her family and, you know, him struggling with, like, is he a part of it? Is he not? He's supposed to go to dinner with them.
The guilt side of it coming back.
Yeah, they really like to do this in superhero movies where you're like, I've got powers, guilt. I saved some people, but also guilt.
For sure.
This outfit, it makes me look very good, but other people in the world are unattractive. Guilt.
Also got
it's very hard to be Andrew Garfield.
I was going
to
say Andrew Garfield.
He's very attractive. And it's
really
all,
well.
Yeah, he does. He's very good.
And my not to go over Emma Stone part of it, but now her being in the movie, like, to me, that was a part of the movie that clicked the most. I know it got the effects. I loved the visual elements of seeing Spider-Man fight. But the part of it, like the character parts that actually worked for me, were those moments between Emma and Andrew, when it was just those two working together.
Can't keep me away.
It's at 8 o'clock. Don't be late.
I won't be.
Okay. Once you start expanding the story out to being bigger than Spider-Man and Gwen's relationship, or Peter's and Gwen's relationship, that's where I think this movie really struggled.
Well, yeah. You only really get them in the first act, because a lot of the rest of the movie is not even about them.
Well, it comes back here and there. I think I like the element, the scene on the bridge. Like, we're jumping way ahead, right? But the scene eventually on the bridge is kind of cheesy, but I'm all for cheese in superhero movies, because I'm like, come on, if you can't embrace the cheesiness in superhero movies, then you kind of are taking these, in my mind, the wrong way. But so I appreciate those little elements that are sprinkled in. But yeah, I think that's probably why the movie like fell flat a little bit, is that it didn't reference the Gwen Stacy Peter Parker relationship enough throughout.
Right. So here's what we need to know. They're supposed to go out to dinner. He feels like he can't go out to the dinner, but he's like outside. So she comes out to him. She's like, come on, man, let me make my own decisions. I know my dad said the thing, which I'm glad that at least he told her, you know, unlike other Spider-Men where they keep that shit a secret, but he told her what the deal was. So she basically says, I should be able to make this decision. And then he says, I don't know about that. And she's like, I broke up with you just then. Bye. Peace.
I break up with you.
Then he walks away.
Yeah. So they split up. And that's now we're set up for the fact that they're not together. Bummer. But now we've got to deal with some other stuff.
Well, and
that
others,
being Dane DeHaan, right? That's where we go after that.
Absolutely. So we end up meeting Harry Osborn. He comes home. His father is sick at his deathbed and hit with a pretty terrible physical affliction and lots of anger directed toward his father.
You have such potential, Harry. Such fierce intelligence, and you're throwing it all away.
No, you threw me away.
Oh, yeah, they're both mad at each other. He, you know, Norman's like, you're a disappointment, and I hate you. And also, BTW is this disease that's killing me is hereditary. So I don't know if you've noticed, but you've got it. It probably just started, and you're going to die faster than me because I'm resilient and you suck.
Peace. What a terrible father.
He's a really bad dude.
Bad pop.
Chris Cooper's very good at playing a villain. Do you know that he was that he auditioned to play Dr. Otto Octavius in Spider-Man 2? Yeah. Fun fact. He did. He would have been a very villainous version of that character. But yeah, he's a real douche here. He basically like lays it all out that Harry is sick. Harry's going to die of the same affliction, and then he dies.
Retroviral hyperplasia. That's what it's apparently called. It's
definitely a real thing.
Yes, absolutely. I remember that.
Jeez.
Somebody in this room has got it.
There we go.
Oh, God. It's a 1 in 4 chance.
Yeah.
But one important takeaway from here also is that we find out Norman leaves the sum total of all his work to Harry.
Yeah.
So Harry is going to be carrying on the mantle for that. But from here, we segue into a pretty pivotal scene, which is what happens when Dylan tries to... he's an electrical engineer at Oscorp and tries to attend to some kind of power malfunction. Mm-hmm. What happens there, John?
So the power malfunction, it's not clear exactly why it starts to happen, but everybody's evacuated except for him. And of course, effing Smythe, whatever the heck that guy's first name is. But Smythe says, nope, sorry, you can't go, even though we're evacuating literally the entire freaking building. So
you get to work, and he's it's my birthday, and he's like, I don't care,
he's
man.
He's like, I don't
sorry.
Care. Sorry, dude. Go play it and have fun with the eels. So, of course, there's a tank of electric eels, some sort of TBD experiment like done on those eels, and Max is up above it trying to fix whatever went wrong because of the power failure.
Dylan, you stay here.
What?
There's a current flow problem in the genomics lab. Why don't you stay and take a look at that?
But it's my birthday. Everybody else is leaving. Why do I have to stay?
Because you're special.
He literally radios up a guy. He's like, hey, I'm above here in this really dangerous situation. And the guy's like, no, I can't turn it off. I got to go. Like, they're evacuating the building. Like, I'm like, come on, man. Like, really? Like,
it's kind of comedic, isn't it?
It is. It is ridiculous. It's like, this guy's life is so bad. People don't care at all about him.
Well, this is like, just straight, this is like less Spider-Man and more Batman to me. I always thought this was like the most Batman thing to ever happen in a Spider-Man movie.
Yes.
Because getting your superpowers from super eels is a super Batman-y thing to do. Like, that seems like a Batman villain move, doesn't it?
It does.
My last name is Freeze, and so I got colded up into a cold guy. It's just like every Batman villain has kind of got that vibe to them.
Mm-hmm. Or some cats hovered over me, and now I have 9 lives.
Yes.
Yeah, that's it. He's exactly right. He's just like Catwoman, except he's Eel-Man. Why didn't they go with that? Great name, Eel-Man.
It's like, damn, that is the worst security guard ever. Just be like, hey, no, I can't shut off the power on your sector because I got to bounce. Like, ah, man. Of course, so he falls into the tank. Yeah, there you go. He turns into Electro.
Happy birthday.
The birth of Electro there. Hi.
I'm going to light my own candles.
Yeah. Oh, boy. Yeah. Even the lines are very Batman and Robin kind of stuff.
It is kind of like that. Yeah.
Well, we actually see him later on at the morgue, and he's got that nice little post-death glow going on.
Well, first he's covered in ash or something. Yeah, he's like in like a cocoon almost of dead skin, and then it breaks away, and then he's all like blue and shiny. What do you think about the look of that?
It reminded me of Star Wars Blue Milk, now in hindsight, to be honest. I don't know why that was the top of my mind when I was watching it. It was like if you took like a blue milk bath and you just got out of it and like you have some like glowy parts to you, that's what it reminded me of.
Oh, interesting.
I think it's wildly inconsistent. There are some scenes where it looks great, but there are some scenes where it feels like they cut costs and it looks like straight out of a video game. But like the look on a whole, I mean, it's very different, obviously, from the main universe. It was supposed to be more like the ultimate version of Electro.
Well, this one actually reminded me of that senator from the first X-Men movie.
Right?
Remember that?
Mm-hmm.
You can see everything going on underneath.
Melting. His skin is melting. Not melting, but see-through, translucent.
So we have Electro. Electro is born, but also, we've kind of skipped ahead a little bit, but Peter has reconnected with Harry.
Oh, yeah.
At this point.
They were friends. They weren't friends. Now they're friends again.
But we also introduce a pretty shady fellow named Donald Menken, who has some designs going on about Oscorp as a whole, and isn't quite sure about how Harry fits in to all of that. So a lot of shady people.
Nowhere, probably. You know, he's some snot-nosed rich kid who doesn't really know what's good for him.
Well, I've seen that before. Yeah, typical like kid trying to take over the company, and then big evil bad guy trying to take that company back from him and like ostracize the kid. That sort of thing happens.
Well, yep. There you go.
Happened to you? Wow, this seems like really personal.
Ghost talking to me, getting companies taken away. Yeah.
Speaking from experience, man.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I've had all superhero movies combined into one, and it's my life.
That's it.
Well, all of this sets up the next big set piece for us, which is the big showdown in Times Square. But one thing that I thought was really funny, it's a pet peeve of mine. So you have Peter and Gwen sort of together on the High Line before this, you know, kind of making up and everything. I don't know if it's just me, but one of my pet peeves is how movies completely rearrange geographies and streets and everything, and suddenly you can see Times Square from the High Line.
Yeah, and it's wild that they did that considering the fact that this was a very rare example of a movie actually being shot in New York. Mm-hmm. It's one of the only Spider-Man, I think it's still the only one to really be shot in New York, like New York, you know, like... Yeah. The last Spider-Man movie in the MCU had some stuff that they shot in Queens, but it's not all shot there. And this was shot entirely in New York City and New York State, the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
So it is kind of weird that they would still somehow mangle the geography.
Yeah, it was pretty bizarre.
Why force it? It's not like you needed to see exactly down in Times Square from the High Line. Like, you could find a way to write to a different location for that if you needed that shot, right? It's like
What I thought was interesting is if you notice other parts of the movie, they went to great pains to really be completely faithful to how the city is set up. Like you recognize certain shops where they're supposed to be, so they really did stick to that. But
it's the most New York Spider-Man movie. Yep. There's another thing I can say in favor of Amazing Spider-Man 2. It is the most New York Spider-Man movie, and it was the biggest movie production ever mounted in New York City.
Mm-hmm.
Very rare that happens these days. Like, the only other movie I can think of that they shot in New York recently that cost a little bit of money was Greatest Showman with Hugh Jackman, another superhero of sorts. But yeah, it's very rare that really, really big movies get shot in New York. It's usually smaller pictures and comic book movies, even ones that get made in New York, are usually not big ones. Like The Kitchen, that's like a Dark Horse comic or Vertigo comic, I think.
Yeah.
That's like a small budget one that's coming out this year, and that's technically set in New York, but it's not like they spent like $200 million on this movie, didn't they?
Well, they pulled out all the stops, certainly for the Times Square thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So we're in Times Square. You get your Max Dillon, who is now all electroed out and such.
Mm-hmm.
And
blue milked out.
Yeah.
Sean would say.
He drank way too much blue milk.
Too much blue milk.
That's it. He's going to
blue milk and electric eels, and you look like that.
I'll tell you right now, it's not good for the stomach. That's it. He's gonna have the trots later. Anyway, but in the meantime, he doesn't really understand what's going on. He doesn't understand his powers. Everybody around him is scared. But Spider-Man, Peter Parker, rolls in. He's got a good idea, which is to not be a dick about it and to try and pacify this guy. Max is like, I know who you are. You saved me in the city. And Peter, being, you know, your friendly neighborhood Spider-Man, it's like, yeah, I remember who you are. I didn't recognize you at first on account of the blue milk.
I can see that. I can see you don't want to be here. I can see you're scared. I can see you don't know what's happening to you. I can see that you don't want to hurt anybody. It's going to be all right.
Got a clear shot. Standing by.
I don't want them shooting me.
I'm not going to shoot you. You guys, this is my buddy Max. I told you about Max. No one shoots him, Max.
He tries to keep things cool, but the cops basically mess it up.
There's always that one like happy trigger dude, man, and any sort of like
that's another
stand-down
superhero trait, man.
Such a tropey movie. This is such a tropey movie.
That happened in Magneto in the Apocalypse movie too, where like one guy kills his family and then he's got to murder.
Yep,
it's the same deal.
With Dark Phoenix. Like,
yeah, Electra just gets real. Yeah, Electra gets real mad about it, lights it up, and gets the hell out of there.
Just like the happy trigger officer soldier like trope, like that one always gets me too. It's like, come on, man, like you're trained so much for these scenarios, and I know people mess up, but like it's been under control. He's not doing anything at that point. Like, that's not the point to fire. If you want to fire 5 seconds or like 5 minutes ago when the dude was like electrifying the stairs, right? Don't fire when like literally nothing is happening.
Well, they do end up capturing Electro, so.
Well, that's right. I forgot, because they beat him out with water, right? They water him up.
They
actually put
truck.
Blue milk on him.
It's like, I don't know if it's water, like that, you know, the fire hydrant, like foamy stuff that comes out of it.
pretty much neutralizes
him. That's
right.
I forgot that happened. Mm-hmm. And I literally just watched this movie and it's already...
it's already a blur.
Yeah.
Well, Electro is under lock and key now, so mm-hmm. he's apprehended. But we do have a pretty interesting reveal going on here where Peter's back home and we go through we see him going through his dad's briefcase. And this is when we start to realize that there are a couple of clues hidden in mm-hmm. there that we did not realize might play a bigger role. He sees Roosevelt. He tries to decode it. He creates a big clue board going on. And so that becomes the next ongoing strand in this movie to try to figure out what secrets are in that briefcase.
Yeah, but so there's like a dual mystery happening, right? Because he's doing that. And then... Harry Osborn is also doing his thing. He's trying to figure out what to do about his disease. He knows that there's like the spider serum, but you know, maybe there's this like black archive available where they kept something. Like these things got destroyed, but there's still this other stuff that's left over that could still be used. And he finds that out from a now, I guess you would say, familiar face, which is Felicity Jones, who's playing Felicia Hardy, who would have, I guess, eventually been Black Cat had things turned out the way that they initially planned. Of Rogue One, A Star Wars Story, you got your Felicity Jones show up. Did you know that both Felicity Jones and Andrew Garfield were both in Doctor Who?
Did not know that.
Both in the Doctor Who. Both, it's two actors with the Doctor Who connection.
If the Black Cat movie would have happened, there may have been a lesser chance that Felicity Jones would have been in Rogue One. And that would have really upset me. I thought she did great in that movie.
I thought she was amazing there. Right? That's a good point.
So don't take it away. I'm kind of glad that didn't happen just so I can get her in Rogue One.
But yeah, they were gonna figure it out, right? Yeah. And they deleted... So this is like one of those interesting things is that got mostly left on the cutting room floor.
Yeah.
Is that apparently she was a much bigger part in this movie. And apparently at some point they had a relationship, her and Harry. Like, apparently they're, like, dating in one of the cuts of the movie. You know, also Mary Jane Watson was in this movie at one point, and they cut her out. Shailene Woolley had played the role, and they just cut her out.
I'm kind of glad. There's already enough characters.
Well, isn't that interesting? Yeah, but, like, this is already a really... It was 2 hours and 21 minutes or whatever. Mm-hmm. It's a long-ass movie. But, yeah, there was all this stuff that was originally in that they pulled out. I guess it would have been, like, a three-hour. It would have been, like, an Avengers Endgame-length movie if they had kept all this stuff in.
It's kind of sad, though, because we know the backstory to a lot of this, and so we see the potential that could have been, you know, with a Black Cat movie, or if they had gone with a part three. But with none of that, and you watch this and just take it at face value, you end up leaving feeling like this pretty amazing actress was so underutilized in this movie for many reasons, but unfortunately that's the big takeaway.
Yeah, but there's two things that are happening concurrently, right, which is that... Harry is finding out the stuff that he still has access to that could potentially cure him. And Peter is also finding out some stuff, which is like what his dad had been up to and all of these things about his background and creating the spider stuff, and how the reason why Peter was able to become Spider-Man is because part of those things, part of the science, was created off of his dad's DNA. So that it could only ever work with somebody with similar DNA. I don't know how accurate the science is on that, but it suggests that this stuff that still exists, that's still out there, would not be effective for anybody except for Peter. But Dane DeHaan, Harry Osborn, is like coming to Peter and he's like, you know, Spider-Man, can you please? I'm a huge fan and also I need his blood. So these are the two plots that are kind of converging. Which is very complicated, right? Because we're supposed to, like, Electro was supposed to be the villain of this movie, and now all of a sudden, in slides a completely different villain story.
Right, and I was wondering, when I was first watching this movie, like, way back 5 years ago, I was wondering where the hell they were going with this, because I was like, they're not going to force two big villains into the same movie, right? I was like, maybe this would be set up for Amazing Spider-Man 3 or something else like that, where Harry comes along, helps him this movie, eventually turns bad in the next movie, similar to kind of what you had in the first three Spider-Man movies with Tobey Maguire. But damn, like, fast-track villainizing him, like, for lack of a better term. Like,
the big story was that they wanted Amazing Spider-Man 2 to be this particular comic where Gwen Stacy dies, right? Like, spoilers for a movie that came out 5 years ago. But that was their intent, and they wanted to keep a certain amount of things accurate. And by that, I mean they wanted it to still be Green Goblin that was going to be the one that killed her off. And lo and behold, they don't have him right now. Who they have is Electro, which means now they have to do all of this heavy lifting in the second and third act in order to make this be a thing that they can actually pull off, which means that Electro has to go bye-bye. So Electro is just gone for this whole section of the movie. He is locked up, like he's under constant sedation and
being tested.
Yeah, yeah, being prodded or whatever. But he's mostly unconscious, not aware of what's going on. And yeah, I'm trying to help me out here, Alexis. Like I said, there's a convergence of so many things that are happening. I'm trying to remember what's going on.
Well, at this point, we can keep our attention on Harry Osborn, and we really see him start to unravel. And, you know, Spider-Man comes and visits him, and I just think it's interesting that he has no idea that it's his friend, does not recognize his voice, but hey, it's a superhero movie, and these things happen.
Everybody believed it when it was James Franco.
I
guess it's because James Franco, like, played Harry Osborn as kind of like a derpy guy. Like, he was like, hey, Pete. You know, he's not really that intelligent, whereas Dane DeHaan has, like, he seems more like a put together, like, logical, reasonable person, so it's kind of a harder sell that he wouldn't know. They're spending a lot less time together. That's the excuses they give, that Peter and Harry haven't talked for a while. They're not really biffles. And, yeah, so Harry, completely unravels, you're right, because he wants the blood of Spider-Man, and Peter says no, and Spider-Man says no. He's like, I just can't help you out, man. Sorry, homie. So he flips out, and also this dude from Oscorp is going to fire him. Or not just fire, but, like, get him, like, arrested or, like, some nonsense. Like, they're going to get rid of him completely from Oscorp. They're just going to, like, wipe him off so that they can continue controlling the company and have him not be involved at all, because they think Harry Osborn's an idiot and he just is not going to be capable of doing the evil doings that they want to do.
Yeah, and then you see the part where, like, Harry goes off the deep end, right? When someone that's so desperate and dying and has to try to find any way, scrape by, try to get, you know, live a little bit longer, find a way to, and he goes and frees Electro. That's the catalyst for the next act of the movie, is like him going downstairs, making buddy-buddy with Jamie Foxx, Blue Milk Jamie Foxx, and
letting him go. What a great story arc. He just wants a friend. Blue Man Group just need, like, he just needs those two other Blue Man Groups.
Blue and green.
If he just had another, no, man, he does not blue and green. He just needs, like, the guy that, like, has a really big Blue Man Group eye and the other one that, like, hits random stuff and makes sounds.
That,
like,
would be amazing.
That's it. If they just had two more blue guys, you know, they could have brought in Beast and Nightcrawler. And then he would have been set.
Marvel-DC
crossover, he would have gotten the friends that he needs and everything would have been right. That would have been like, and it's New York City, so the Blue Man Group all adds up. Perfect. I'm glad I could solve this movie.
Off-Broadway placement.
You know, my cousin actually lived in an apartment right next to the Blue Man Group, so he could, like, sometimes hear it in the night.
That's
a true story. But instead, Harry Osborn comes and is like, I'll be your bud.
Because I need you. Yes, I need you. You are my only chance that I have at surviving.
You need me.
Yes.
I really feel for Jamie Foxx, who's really, again, I feel gives it his all. And they just make everything with him, instead of being like the first Amazing Spider-Man movie, which, like, their whole idea was that it would be a more serious, like, on the ground tone and aesthetic. And I think that, you know, Jamie Foxx came in thinking that was the type of movie that he was going to get with Amazing Spider-Man 2. And instead, all of his scenes play out like Batman Forever / Batman and Robin.
Yeah. No, absolutely that. And you see it in Jamie's portrayal. Like, it's so cheesy, but the look in his eye is actually really good. Like, his transition from being, like, pissed off and angry to being very genuine is, like, was really good acting in my side. But the writing and the editing of it falls to make it be cheesy instead of, like, hit home.
But just like in real life, when I assume that the executive producers came to Jamie Foxx and said, we need you. And he was like, you need me? Just like that, the first black superhero and the first black supervillain in the history of the Spider-Man movie universe gets completely sidelined for some random white kid. a yoink. So that happens. But yeah, so like they go in together. There's all that, I need you, you need me, blah, 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 back and forth. And so Electro takes Harry back to Oscorp so that he can kill off this asshole that took over the company, go down to the secret lab and save himself. So they go down and do that, and he gives himself a jabby jab of this of the spider serum.
Secret sauce.
Yeah, he gets that secret sauce, and it does not go great.
But while all of this is happening, Peter's also making some big discoveries of his own. What do we find out there, John?
Yeah, so you find the subway tokens from what we were talking about earlier, of uncovering clues about what his father did and the research he's doing. And, you know, of course, subway tokens goes to unlock secret subway car out of the ground, out of nowhere, that nobody knew was there except for his father.
Did you ever use a subway token?
Me?
Yeah, I remember
Did you ever use one? Did you ever live in New York during the time when the tokens were still there?
I never
there?
Lived here when they were here, but I've used them when I visited before I lived here.
Okay.
But yeah.
Yeah. I just wanted to establish that it's a bunch of old people doing this podcast. Because it's been a long time. When I was a kid and we used to visit New York, because I grew up in New Jersey, we used the tokens.
Oh, yeah.
So yeah, that's like a fun throwback.
It is. It reminds me of arcade games.
And also it's very Ninja Turtles. Like he finds the thing in the underground. I was like, are the Ninja Turtles going to pop up?
By the way,
can you imagine a Spider-Man Ninja Turtles crossover movie? That'd be sick.
That'd be amazing.
Yes, it would be an amazing Spider-Man movie.
Oh, shit. And I feel like him and Michelangelo are pretty much like similar characters. Like Spider-Man, true blue Spider-Man, not Spider-Man in this movie necessarily, but true Spider-Man and Michelangelo. Are kind of pretty close. Like if you combine like maybe Donatello and Michelangelo into one person, then you've
got the science.
Yeah, you got the science and the quirkiness, but that's kind of him. But
yeah,
anyway,
he is.
Very tangent.
Yes, he both does machines and is a party dude. You are correct.
Yes.
So he finds that stuff out. He sees the video of his dad.
Maybe they're right. I always thought that I'd have more.
Peter hears his own childhood voice in the background.
I'm sorry.
Gets very emotional. And he's like, oh, snap. I don't remember actually what happens at this point, to be honest. Hold on, fill it in, remind me.
Well, by this point, actually, we start to see Harry become the Green Goblin. He gets injected with that serum, which pretty much just escalates everything that's going on in his body.
Oh, yeah, and he puts himself in the suit because he's like, I'm going to die if I don't get in the suit. Somehow he knows to put himself in the suit. Did they give any explanation as to why he would know to get into the suit?
Feeling.
Oh,
he
yeah.
He had a feeling. I don't know.
Yeah.
No, he didn't give any explanation.
He just gets into it. It like attaches to his body and it kind of heals him,
and
sort of.
It saves him.
Yeah, that's right. It prevents him from dying right then and there. But now he's kind of like scarred up. His hair's all over the place.
It's got like metal shit coming out of his head.
Yeah, he kind of looks a little jokery, people would say at the time, that he's got a little bit of a Joker vibe. But there's no time for that shit because Electro is off destroying that grid.
And now Electro's back, so now we've got Spidey facing pretty much two foes.
Right,
but
he doesn't know that yet.
He doesn't know that yet, right. But Peter enlists the help of Gwen to help.
Well, she enlists herself.
She does.
Yeah.
Correct.
By the way, there's two plots that we should point out. I feel kind of bad that we basically left all the women in the dust. Gwen Stacy is going to go to Oxford. She's going to leave. That's the story that's happening. Like they didn't actually get back together per se, because she's going to go to Oxford.
Facebook status, relationship status. It's complicated.
It's complicated. Yeah. Oxford. So that's happening, and also Aunt May is working at a hospital. That's another thing that's happening. We should probably mention that Aunt May is in this movie. played by Sally Field. I don't want to, you know, like, it's kind of shitty to not mention that, you know, like, one of the most famous actresses of the last, like, quarter century, or like, last half century, to be honest, is in this movie. She's not in it much, but she is there.
Well, and I think that's another part of why it kind of fell flat, right? Like, I wish, to your point earlier, Danny, I wish there was those Gwen Stacy, Peter Parker moments throughout the movie and not just here and then there, right? That should be a through line.
Yeah,
Aunt May should
be here, there,
and
everywhere, like the Beatles song.
That works. And then Aunt May is same way. Like, those are his emotional ties. They're not used enough throughout, I think, Acts 2 and 3 in particular, to really kind of keep some continuity there. They're always in his mind, right? Especially the guilt with Gwen and the relationship and his kind of struggle with them being apart, but not necessarily as much as like is integrated to the plot as we could. They're kind of just there to give him stakes at the very end.
Yeah. So now, you know, he doesn't want Gwen to be involved in this fight, but Gwen basically says, she also, by the way, worked for Oscorp, and the thing we should probably have mentioned, she worked for Oscorp, so she knows the same thing about this electrical grid. She understands how it works. She would know how to reset it. She knows how to help. And so she basically convinces Peter that she's got to be a part of this. She's got to get helped out. JK, because he webs her up. And he's like, I got it. Thanks. Bye. Thanks for the info. Peace. So he like runs off. She gets herself unwebbed and goes to chase after. So while she's en route to help him out, he's getting into the fight with Electro. And Electro is using the electrical grid like it's a cool like MIDI machine. He's going to drop some
serious beats.
I don't know when the beat's going to drop. It's like all techno songs where you're like, when's the beat going to drop? And like your head's just going to explode because it's about to drop. But instead he just plays Itsy Bitsy Spider, which is weird.
Yeah, I think music choices throughout this movie are a little bit
questionable. Yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, so like he's up there, he's playing music on the enormous electrical machine. That's actually like, was this place in Brooklyn? Because this is some like Brooklyn hipster nonsense.
It seemed like Dumbo or something.
It is. Yeah. Oh my God.
You can see it from the bridge. Yeah.
Let's just assume that it's in Dumbo. Because you could see any Brooklyn hipster would be getting up to using a giant electrical grid to play weird songs.
That's exactly
what would happen. Makes sense to me. So yeah, they're getting into a fight. Spider-Man's trying to stop him. And this is sort of my beef with the scene is that this is where I think some of the special effects for Electro start to look a little flat. Like if you look at him, he looks bad. Everything else looks fine, but he looks weird in a lot of these scenes, I noticed. This is a podcast, so I can't like throw up an image, but go back and watch it and you'll see that there's like a bunch of sequences where he looks, especially like that uncanny valley between a real person and a CGI character. I think you can really see it there.
Yeah. And this is a part where it's like, you kind of need to embrace the campiness, or I wish they would have embraced the campiness a little bit. Because, like, to your point, then the look, I wouldn't feel as bad about the look, or I wouldn't feel as bad about some of these lines that they say when they're about to fight. Because if you just embrace the campiness and the cheesiness of it, then, cool, I got you. Like, I have a very much, in hindsight, love and appreciation for Batman and Robin. Not that it's an amazing movie or whatnot, but just like how ridiculous it was. I would have had that still probably like looking back on this movie if they embraced that a little bit more, but it was still fighting with like, do we do serious based off the first movie or do we go and lean into how this movie actually is turning out, which is cheesy.
Yeah, I think that was a problem of this movie was that it couldn't quite figure out the tone.
The tone and the emotional connections, right? Really tough.
But they fight.
Awesome action sequence. I thought the effects, besides maybe the look of Electro, the effects themselves were really cool. I love seeing Spider-Man be able to fly between those electrical towers.
Yeah, yeah. They made an electrical thing perfect for Spider-Man.
Hell yeah!
Why not? So there's that that's going on.
And they do take down Electro.
They do. Gwen eventually shows up and helps out and they take down Electro and the
hooray. That's not the end of it yet.
No, because,
what happens next?
Green Goblin shows up. Although interestingly, they never say any of the names of these characters, by the way. They never say Electro and they never say Green. Do they actually say it?
Yeah.
Do they
Jamie
actually
Fox
say it?
Says I'm Electro.
Does
I think
he?
when Harry and him are like, Harry's freeing him, he's asking who he
really,
is and says that, I think.
It's really weird. He's just, they don't really give a good, I mean, like, I guess it makes sense that that would be his name, but like, they never say, but they don't say Green Goblin. That never happens.
No, but didn't you think when he came flying in that, I don't know, I thought he looked like a really punk, really angry Leonardo DiCaprio.
I can see that.
Right?
Spent too much time out in the sun. Yeah.
Angry Leo post Romeo and Juliet and after the Titanic sank.
Good. All those things.
I don't really like the look of Green Goblin, but I think Dane DeHaan has a good look for Green Goblin, if that makes sense, right? I think there's like stuff in there that I like to see. Like he could have been a really cool Green Goblin if it wasn't so like, I don't know. Metal stuff coming out of his head kind of weirded me out, but he was creepy as hell.
Yeah. Was. They had this major showdown.
Yeah, for reasons. For reasons. Because he's like, I knew it was you, Peter.
Peter. When you said Spider-Man said no, you meant you said no.
It wasn't you saying no. It wasn't Spider-Man saying no. It was you saying no, Peter.
Yeah, things got very personal now between them. But at this point, the movie kind of takes a pretty dark turn.
Yeah, because they kill Gwen Stacy.
Mm-hmm. Tell us about that.
They kill Gwen Stacy. Glad I could sum it up for you. No, they go inside of this weird mechanized. It looks like they're inside of a big clock.
Clock tower.
That's what I thought. Right?
Right? It's very clock tower all of a sudden. You're like, why are we?
Is this Peter Pan?
It's just a really different space all of a sudden. It's really kind of odd in that way. But yeah, like they're constantly like getting like sidelined by gears and stuff, trying to block gears, trying to move gears. It's just everybody's a gearhead in this situation. And Gwen just, she keeps falling a little bit here and there, fall a little bit, and then she falls too far, and Peter tries to get her with his web, and that turns into like a little helping hand, like, yeah, I'm gonna help you, but then her head cracks on the ground, and she dead.
Remind me of one of those like sticky hands you got at like Chuck E. Cheese or like whatever, Great Times back in the day. You use like $25 of tokens to buy one of those little dudes like, that slaps on things and gets dirty.
With like stretchy fingers.
Yes.
There we go.
But just for me, it's like, again, I feel like that was supposed to be very dramatic, and it just, every time I watch it, I hear like a little baby voice in my head being like, I'll save you. Like, it's just, and I'm like, it's not going to happen, baby voice, I'm sorry. And they say, yeah, her head gets cracked, and it's pretty grim. Sounds like, you're like, oh.
Of course, now I'm never going to look at it and think that he bought those webs in Chuck E. Cheese.
That's where his inspiration for the webs were.
Right, it's Chuck E. Cheese. But yes, it is quite grim. We do hear a pretty gnarly crack going on, and Peter is devastated.
Yeah, and meanwhile, Dennis Leary is like, fucking told you. That's it. That's the moral of the movie. Listen to Dennis Leary, folks. He knows what's up. Pull up your pants and make the coffee flavored like coffee, not maple nut crunch. That's a deep Dennis Leary joke. Listen, somebody out there is going to be like, I remember that Dennis Leary joke. You're welcome.
They'll appreciate it.
#The ref. I bet you saw it. I bet you saw that one too. Anyway.
This scene, I think, like all in one, encapsulates a lot of the good and bad of the movie. The ridiculous, why are we in the gear tower? Gears flying over the place. The of her like falling gradually is all kind of off for me. But then once she dies, or the shots right before she dies, like that one reflective shot in the eye, I thought that was really cool. I think the hearing the crack and then how her body just like limply dangled there was like creepy as hell. So they got some parts bad, but some
movie.
Parts good.
It totally is.
But it's like, I see the potential. I see that. That's good. But that's bad. That's not so good. You know, it's tough bouncing between those two. They're good parts.
So then Dane DeHaan is out for the count. He just gets knocked out. He's like knocked out in a corner. And
Peter's in mourning.
Yeah, he's crying it up. And movie over, you would think, but no. So you got your grave site scene, which transitions pretty quickly, right? Like he's there, and then they basically suggest that he just goes to the grave like every day, and it's been a minute. Like he's been there, he just keeps going for a while.
All the seasons.
And things are going really badly. Like the city's not in great shape. Spider-Man isn't showing up to save the day anymore. It's like all of a sudden, like with the 5 minutes to go, we're full Tobey Maguire movie. All of a sudden, like, where's Spider-Man? Yeah. I'm Spider-Man no more. Like they decide to throw that Tobey move at the end of this movie.
It was so rushed. That part was really rushed.
It's really rushed. But I'll tell you this, the note that they end on, as dumb as part of it is, there is a part that upon rewatch I really liked. So the end of this movie basically is he rewatches the old speech that Gwen gave.
But we will carry a piece of each other into everything that we do next to remind us of who we are and of who we're meant to be.
And the speech he hears inspires him to realize that, you know, at his darkest moment, he has to still be willing to step up. Mm-hmm. That's sort of the defining characteristic of a hero and of a life that is well-lived and earned. And so Rhino is out there. He's got a suit somehow. He got it from Oscorp.
Well, it's not the last we've seen of Harry yet either, right?
Right. Well, that's like the end. But so Rhino's out there. He's going to steal some jewels or whatever he's doing. Paul Giamatti is there once again, not crying while he's buying stuff at the food market. He's doing his ridiculous Russian accent, having a ball. and what should happen, but there's no Spider-Man, so like there's just a little kid there, and the little kid's got the Spider-Man suit in because he still believes, and so the kid steps out and he puts the mask on like he's gonna save the day. And I have to say, it's funny because the first time I watched this in the theaters, it didn't land for me. But rewatching it, I think it's friggin' great. I actually think this is the best scene in the whole goddamn movie. I think this is it.
Hey, Spider-Man.
I knew you'd come back.
Yeah, thanks for stepping up for me. You're the bravest kid I've ever seen.
The kid's there. The kid stands up, recognizing that the city wants Spider-Man, needs Spider-Man, loves Spider-Man, that he has inspired people to such a degree that this kid really believes that he could do it. And of course, like, he's a little kid, he can't actually do it, but like, this kid is so inspirational that he could inspire the man who actually has inspired the city. It's this beautiful cycle between Spider-Man and New York. And he shows up and he's like, hey, I'm going to take a kid. And then he goes and is going to fight Rhino. And that's amazing. I just think that, like, Spider-Man stepping up right next to that little kid dressed as Spider-Man is gold. That's such a great moment. And why was the whole movie not of this caliber? Like, if you wanted to do a darker, more serious film, right, but, like, still has that hope of Spider-Man, like, that's, to me, it's like that scene in Spider-Man 2 when everybody helps Spider-Man, like, into the subway, and they all see his face, but they say, "We'll keep your secret, Spider-Man." They give him back the mask and everything. Like, the idea that everybody's on his side, that quintessential scene, like, this is such a cool take on it. I actually think it's, like, it's great. I'm open to points of dissension on this, but I actually think it really, I wish the whole movie was of that caliber. Great moment.
No, I not necessarily my favorite scene of all the movie, but I'm not going to disagree with any point you just made there, because I think the one thing this movie doesn't really include are a lot of those, like, neighborhoody moments, like the personal connection that Spider-Man has and how much he inspires people. You see mostly people hating on him for being a vigilante, and I know you got a little bit of the neighborhoody stuff from the last movie, Amazing Spider-Man, the first one, but I think, to your point, like, that's what was missing a lot of this movie, are like the stuff that makes Spider-Man special as a character, a superhero character, is like, yo, you're one from the neighborhood. Like, you are the dude down the block that just put on a costume because you have special powers, nothing normal or nothing, like, different about you, and that sort of, like, New York supporter group that ends up coming up to help him. And I like the seeing that little kid try.
I like it. It's real good.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
So what was your favorite scene from the movie? I mean, Spider-Man's back, and under the assumption that there would have been a third movie, but I guess that didn't happen. Know.
That honestly is my favorite scene. That's the one that really sticks out to me, just because it feels quintessentially New York. It feels quintessentially Spider-Man. Mm-hmm. Like, there is that thing that is just, you know, it's the opposite of the unnecessary, here's his dad's secret science backstory, which gives a shit. Like, that's the stuff that I hate the most about that movie, is just, I don't need this, and I don't need this weird mystery. We've already got his family shit on lock. We've got that. We've got the Aunt May, Uncle Ben stuff. It's there. I don't need anything else. But this is a really cool twist on, like I said, in Spider-Man 2, they go, oh, he's just a kid. Meanwhile, this time, it's the kid that's just a kid, and Spider-Man comes and helps the kid out, and it's like, you know, it's kind of amazing. I would say it's still my favorite scene.
Yeah, it was a pretty great moment. What about you, John?
My favorite scene, I think the one that I remember the most, or that I will constantly remember the most, is just the action sequences. I think they did a great job with those. Like, seeing him, like, fly throughout the electrical, like, not towers, but, like, whatever those little electrical things were in that field against Electro. I thought that part was awesome. I think Even the web slinging amongst the buildings in the city was really cool. Just them taking chances on showing that action in a different way. Like, I don't want to see the same thing. There's so many cool different aspects of the Spider-Man web slinging you could highlight, and I thought they did a good job of like taking a different stance, a directorial stance, and trying to showcase those. My favorite line was where I wish they embraced the cheesiness more was probably like Jamie Foxx's, "A world without power. A world without mercy, a world without Spider-Man." Like, that was my favorite line, to be honest. I started cracking up. It's like, yo, you're so cheesy. But it's like, you own that. Like, he owned the cheesiness in it, but the rest of the movie just didn't match the tone, you know? But yeah, those are my two favorite parts, probably.
I like that time when Sally Field complains that, like, all the clothes in the laundry turned red and blue. And he's like, I was washing the American flag. What a weird. Did you know? I think that there was some kind of improvisational stuff, like when Gwen goes to have her interview for going all the way to Oxford, and Peter like jumps in. And he's like, "Oh, I can't. I'm sorry to bother you, but like, I don't think they actually had a thing in the script." And he just came in and did like a dozen different weird things that he came up with in the moment. And they just picked. Yeah. One of them, and I thought that was kind of funny too. He's like, I'm from a different school, trying to snatch her up. She's, you know, she's very. I got a jazz. Bye. Is good. It's fun. Yeah, I mean, you said that too, which is that the two of them are pretty good together. Yeah. Andrew Garfield and Emma Stone. Yeah, it's kind of a bummer because you know, like, and part of the, so like you know the big. Thing, the big part story is not the movie. It's all the stuff that happened afterwards, the Sony email leak and all this stuff, wherein you find out that they were talking with Disney about the possibility of doing a crossover thing. And it should have been, in theory, still Andrew Garfield. But I think more than one thing happened. But the one thing we know happened is that apparently he pissed off some executives because he was supposed to like go some places and he didn't show up. There was one place specifically that he was like too sick to show up for, which is maybe in quotes, but maybe legit. And he pissed off some executives and they were like, "Screw you, guy." And they fired him. So like, what could have been? Let me ask you this. How do you like Tom Holland? I assume everybody here really likes Tom Holland. Yep. Do you wish that Andrew Garfield had continued on? If you could have a choice between Tom Holland comes in and takes over or Andrew Garfield continued on as Spider-Man, what would you have taken?
If
do you think it turned out for the best, or do you think that Andrew Garfield would have done better than Tom Holland?
I think they needed to bring in into the MCU a younger looking Spider-Man. So if this was going to continue on and not have Spider-Man in the MCU, I would have been loved to see Andrew Garfield in another movie. But I do think they needed a younger looking Spider-Man to bring into the MCU just to visually illustrate that age difference of what he brings. Because, like, let's be real, Andrew Garfield is supposed to be playing a high schooler, but he looks like he's 25, right? Yeah.
Well, he's 35 right now.
Yeah, exactly.
Right now he's 35.
Okay, so he was 30 years old playing a 18-year-old kid. Graduating high school. So I think they needed someone to look younger in the MCU, but I would have loved to see Andrew Garfield have another shot at like a standalone Spider-Man movie.
Here's another thing I can ask you. A couple days ago, relative to when we're recording this, probably it would be like about 2 weeks from when this actually comes out, but Tom Holland said he would absolutely, if they let him, do a movie with him, Andrew Garfield, and Tobey Maguire. Where they did like a Spider-Man movie where he interacted with the other Spider-Man universes. Would you watch that movie?
Of course. I mean, absolutely.
Do you think it would be a huge success, or do you think people would groan and not go see it? Like, what do you think would happen?
I think it'd feel forced.
I think it's kind of gimmicky. I mean, the thing, although I agree with you, John, here, my favorite part about Amazing Spider-Man 2 was Andrew Garfield and Emma Stone and their chemistry.
That laugh. That's off the table.
My laugh is off the table?
You gotta figure out a more annoying laugh. That's still adorable.
I thought that Andrew Garfield was terrific. He was cast really, really well. He's actually my favorite Spider-Man, and I do like Tom Holland a lot. But I've actually interviewed both of them, and, you know, both great guys. Off camera, but you know what struck me about Andrew Garfield was just this level of thoughtfulness that he had, and I like that he brought that vulnerability, that angst to his characterization here. Maybe it was a little bit too heavy, a little bit too heavy-handed for a Marvel movie, and maybe that's why Tom Holland's version and the way that they decided to take the franchise Homecoming and Far From Home, that's why that click is just tonally, it's so different from what they had done previously. But I really liked Andrew Garfield, and I would have certainly loved to see him again in the third version. I guess it just became a matter of, is that where they want to go? Is that what they wanted to do, given where the MCU as a whole was moving? So those were bigger questions, I think, that went so far beyond just whether one person was right for the role.
And you know how like there in a lot of these big franchises, there's these transition movies, right? Which don't do very much except for like try to do a contained story to set up what the hell is going to come next. You see a lot with Ultron, like Ultron to me, Age of Ultron is a very much a transition movie, trying to get you just to the next phase. It doesn't really do a lot. Does not really high stakes because we all know they're coming back. We're not going to lose anybody, etc. This like, and I know in hindsight, right? We're watching this is a transition movie, but it didn't transition anywhere. Right, there's nowhere to go because there's no third Spider-Man movie. But like, every single part of these elements, seeing the Dr. Ock costume, the Vulture costume, that
right,
rhino
that was
bit
the tag,
at the end,
that was the tagline.
Yeah, like, it, all these is just like a transition movie.
Dr.
That
Kafka.
Now no, it doesn't mean anything because there's no next movie to transition to.
Yeah, the only thing that happened much later was Venom.
Yeah.
Venom, oh, yeah. Venom still did happen.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what they had originally been thinking about it being at the time, but they also were saying like, oh, maybe we'll do like a Silver Sable and a Black Cat. And that's also still stuff that they talk about doing now. So it's interesting. Some things that they were talking about then could still happen. They probably will just be very different from yeah. what was originally envisioned at the time. But I'll tell you this, Into the Spider-Verse, maybe the lowest grossing movie technically of any Spider-Man film, but it did very well for an animated film in theaters. And I will tell you this. I think that if you made a movie with Tobey Maguire, Andrew Garfield, and Tom Holland, if you actually did that, if you did a movie called Spider-Man that was like a, like an Into the Spider-Verse-esque thing with those three guys.
Animated?
No. Like actually yeah. like do a, like a live-action Spider-Man movie, I think that movie would do gangbusters. No joke. I don't know how much you would have to pay to get all three of those actors in, but I do actually think that it would be enormously successful. I'm putting it out
sure.
there that I don't think it'll ever happen. I just don't believe that will ever, ever, ever happen. But if it did, I would be the first person in line to see that movie. I think that movie would be, I don't even know if it would be good, but I would have to see it. I would have to see it.
Well, you'll never know. We're already in sort of a whole multiverse phase right now. So, hey, anything's possible, right?
Entirely possible. I mean, Far From Home, that's like, that's the whole thing. Isn't that interesting? That like now the next movie is talking about that and like
yeah.
this Into the Spider-Verse is a thing and they're having this conversation about all the previous versions of Spider-Man in a way like it's already like an alternate universe kind mm-hmm. of world it's baked in.
I would love to see it as an animated movie. I think that would get around
all
the story issues I could see with it. Is this like have it be an animated movie,
if
have
they had
them voice some characters.
If they had a built-in animated universe the way that DC does, I would 100% see that happening. Like
yeah.
that would have already happened, period. Like they would have just, why not? They would have immediately jumped on it. But I mean, look, maybe they'll find a way. Maybe they'll do like an Into the Spider-Verse thing, except with those three guys. That would be wild. I mean, whatever. I'd take it in any form.
So I guess for Spider-Man, Amazing Spider-Man 2, we can agree, not really a high point in the franchise, huh?
No, I just, it's the fact that it's constantly running against itself. Mm-hmm. Its tone is completely inconsistent. It's the idea of who the villain is supposed to be is completely inconsistent. So you don't get an idea of who it's going to be. I think that the optics are terrible in the sense that here we are. It's the first time that a black actor has ever been a supervillain in a Spider-Man movie. It should be a really big deal. You got Jamie Foxx. He's a big name. And he's completely sidelined. And for this, like, little white guy, Dane DeHaan, and, like, it just looks like shit, I have to tell you. Like, I think that, like, in the year of 2019, people were going to look at that really unfavorably. And I don't think they're wrong to be honest. But even, like, that aside, no, I just think it's a tonal nightmare. It just, they didn't know it. It just becomes so clear that there's too many competing things happening.
Yeah, and it kind of echoes what we've already been saying that way. And that, just to add on to the point, like they didn't double down on the stuff that worked enough to make the whole movie work. The emotional relationship and the chemistry between Andrew and Emma, the graphic elements of it, and utilizing those in certain sections to kind of like, you know, mask some of the kind of lack of villain development in a way. So they didn't double down enough on the really good stuff.
Yeah, I felt
there.
A little half-baked.
Yeah.
Well, at this point, I'm going to go and call in our trusty pal, Warvis. He's going to fill us in on exactly where this stands among all the other movies. We took a poll here at the Sci-Fi Wire offices to find out exactly what this movie's ranking is. So, Warvis, why don't you let us know?
In Sci-Fi Wire's official ranking of the Spider-Verse films, The Amazing Spider-Man 2 ranks number 6 out of 7, just ahead of Spider-Man 3 and just behind The Amazing Spider-Man 1.
6 out of 7.
That's what do you think?
It's a toss-up. I like Spider-Man 3 more than this movie, in hindsight. But I think it's definitely a toss-up. I can see you want people going one way or the other. I'm not going to fight you on these those two rankings.
Yeah, this feels fair to me.
I'll say this. You know, I voted this as the worst, but having rewatched it now, I actually think that this is better than the first Amazing Spider-Man movie. That's my opinion.
Oh, really?
I really don't like that movie in hindsight. I think that what they did with the reptile was an abomination. The lizard, excuse me, the reptile, what the hell's wrong with me? Dr. Connors, it's awful. I hate it so much. In hindsight, I think that this is better than that. I think that as all over the map as it was, the stuff that works in this movie, I like more than the stuff that works in Amazing Spider-Man. So I think this movie deserves a little bit better.
Yeah, I didn't hate The Amazing Spider-Man, but I agree that this one did a better job. I think it tied a couple of loose ends with the storyline with his parents, but also introduced a couple of new heroes, maybe not in the most successful way, but you know, you still wanted to watch until the very end and see what happened. So I mm-hmm. thought they pulled it off to a degree, not completely successful, but an admirable effort.
Yeah, and Paul Giamatti went crazy. The whole movie should have been on Paul Giamatti's level. It all should have been on
yes.
that.
Yes.
There you
I mean,
go.
Between Paul Giamatti and Jamie Foxx's, like, I know he's taking it seriously, but his cheesiness in it, like that,
yeah.
it should have been the tone of this.
There you go.
Like,
yeah. That Make that one. It. Anyway.
Well,
all right.
Couple of ideas. Well, there we go. Well, on that note, that is a wrap for us here. For our Amazing Spider-Man 2 podcast, if you liked what you heard, do check out our other episodes of 8 Days of Spider-Man and subscribe. They are available wherever you get your podcasts. And of course, visit Sci-Fi Wire at sci-fi.com for the latest news about your friendly neighborhood web crawler and much, much more.
Like blue milk.
Like blue milk. On behalf of Danny Roth and John Irwin here, I'm Alexis Loynez at Sci-Fi Wire HQ. Thank you for joining us for 8 Days of Spider-Man, and we'll see you at the theater when Spider-Man Far From Home opens on July 2nd. Until then, do what Spidey might do, just keep swinging along. Goodbye, everyone.